I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, very welcome back. We always much appreciate your being there and listening to this podcast. It's a pleasure to do and a great thrill that so many people seem to be interested in it.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's really good. We're recording this on Bank Holiday Monday, aren't we, Dad? Weather's pretty good.
Yep, we're having a baking bank holiday.
The hottest bank holiday for early Bank Holiday Monday since records began.
Apparently, or allegedly, or possibly.
Yeah.
That is the usual definition of an English summer, 3 days of sunshine followed by a thunderstorm.
Yes, this is very true.
Nothing much changes. I'm going to Manchester to promote my television series on CBS Reality called Murder by the Sea in the next week or so.
Your TV show comes out on the 21st of May.
21st of May, 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock.
CBS Reality.
I'm not going to be here, which is sad.
Never mind. I'm sure they'll be here. Programs that for those of you with a particularly fascinating in this area, you can find the trailer on my website, geoffreywansell.com, or indeed on CBS Reality's website.
Nice. I haven't even checked that out yet. I'll check that out when I
if you Google me, darling, you'll get there.
That's great. So you're trailing on CBS Reality right now?
Yeah, we have been training for a week. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good.
So in the...
And bus sides.
That's you've got buses and billboards. I wish we had them, but they're in Manchester.
Yeah, well, that's why the director and I are going up to see them, see what they're like.
Cool, will you take a picture for me?
We will, absolutely. Couldn't miss it for the world.
Great, so good.
Also in post offices. Those things when you're standing waiting in a queue. The poster is one of those things that rotates up and down. You know, there's usually four or five of them and they go up and then they go down.
I didn't know they had them in post offices.
Apparently they're very successful. Oh. It's an extraordinary fact that true crime now is more popular than it's ever been, and particularly popular with lady viewers. Extraordinary.
Yeah, us ladies love a bit of murder.
I don't know. Not everybody.
Lots of people do.
Yeah.
I had dinner with Areej last night.
Oh, wonderful. How's Areej?
She's good. She listens to our podcast. She said she tells all her friends and everyone she meets about it. So she's responsible for a large amount of our promotion.
I'm delighted to hear it.
And Areej is one of my oldest friends. In fact, I would say my oldest friend. 26 years.
Yes.
Yeah, and she said, but she got to the point where she was listening to so many true crime podcasts that it got a bit much, so she had to tone it down a bit.
Oh, I quite agree. And indeed, somebody's just recently launched one. I think Classic FM or someone's launched a true crime podcast for reasons I cannot understand.
Popularity, I guess.
I guess that's what it is. I'm looking at a book by a man called Tim Weaver at the moment. He's a very good crime novelist. And he's got a podcast. It's not quite true crime. It's called Missing. And it's about how you find people who get lost.
Oh,
yeah. Who disappear. He writes. He's got this character called David Raker who looks for people. And in this ninth in the series, a woman he thought was dead, his wife, returns.
Oh, that's quite cool.
Hmm. It's a very clever idea.
Well, we were meant to talk about that book that's done frightfully well that you...
Let's do it at the end.
Okay, cool.
Let's do it at the
so
end.
So just in full disclosure, listeners, I'm going to Tokyo for 2 weeks. Not just Tokyo, actually. I'm going to Japan, going in other areas of Japan too. So we're recording two podcasts today, which will be spread out. We're going to do the railway killers. And... there's a lot to say about them, so we were always going to do this one in two parts. So it seemed to make sense for us to do that. So we'll have a little break at the end, and then we'll do our kind of usual roundup at the end of the following episode, if that makes sense. Just so that we don't miss any episodes while I'm away. Okay, so we'll get going now with the Railway Killers.
The Railway Killers, John Duffy and David Mulcahy, terrorised, and I do mean terrorised, North London for a period of 4 or 5 years. They started out as rapists and graduated to murder. But let's begin at the beginning. Both men had their roots in Ireland, but were brought up in North London, one in Kilburn, one in Bronsbury. Duffy was Catholic, a short, ginger-haired boy who didn't grow very much. He never got beyond 5'3". And Mulcahy used to call him the midget. Mulcahy, much taller, white, pasty-faced, round, very much the brains of the outfit. Duffy was the brawn, although Mulcahy was capable of dreadful,
Duffy
dreadful
Duffy was
violence.
The brawn and he was 5'3".
Yeah, but he was ferocious. It's not all... there's no doubt in my mind that this was a genuine folie à deux. The two together were much more dangerous than individually they would have been. And this goes all the way back to when they went to Haverstock Hill Comprehensive School in Hampstead in the same year when they were both 11. They were both born in 1959, so that means it would have been 1970. Mulcahy was cleverer and more manipulative than Duffy. Duffy was suggestible. And that's really where all this began. At school, they quickly developed a reputation for, how can one put it, idiosyncratic and later violent behaviour. At one point, Mulcahy famously was suspended from school as a teenager for killing a hedgehog with a plank of wood and then stamping on it while Duffy looked on smirking.
That's horrible.
But as we've said to each other many times, it's one of the characteristics of people who go on to kill serially.
Killing animals.
Is hurting animals. It is one of the absolutely critical signs. And in fact, there's recently been a book detailing what you should look out for in the history of someone who's killed.
Yeah. Definitely common.
Well, as they grew a little older, although in Duffy's case not a little taller, they developed a passion for martial arts and kung fu. It was the 70s, rather in the shadow of Bruce Lee
time.
You know, everyone was jumping about and holding their hands out straight and adopting poses. And they took to practicing on Hampstead Heath, not very far from the school and between their two houses. And then they escalated. They took to wearing Halloween masks and jumping out of the bushes and terrifying people. They took great pleasure.
That's creepy.
Well, they're a pretty creepy couple, actually. They particularly liked terrifying either courting couples who'd gone to Hampstead Heath for a cuddle, or gay couples, which were quite familiar on the Heath in those days, particularly at the Vale of Health. And the more terrified they could make them, the better they liked it. They took an absolute delight in this bizarre behaviour. But it became very apparent that both men had some kind of sexual inadequacy. Duffy had a very low sperm count, which meant that having...
How do you know that?
Well, you do know it now because of the DNA testing. You know it only in retrospect.
Yeah, but men don't know when they have a low sperm count. That doesn't make them feel like... Or do they?
Well, I think sometimes they do.
Okay, anyway, sorry.
Okay, Mulcahy found getting excited very difficult and needed violence to spur him on, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, who stuck by him throughout, told a series of very disturbing stories about what Mulcahy demanded she did. But that sense of violence towards women, and it always was violence towards women, this was not directed at men in any way. All the violence, both from Mulcahy and from Duffy, was directed specifically and directly at women. They leave school, neither of them get much in the way of a qualification. They take up decorating, painting and decorating and carpentry.
And together?
No, they have two separate jobs.
Okay.
Although both at one point work for Westminster City Council. One a carpenter, another.
But they're still friends. But they've taken up a trade.
More than friends. They are partners in every way. They are sorcerer and apprentice.
Okay.
I think Mulcahy is the sorcerer and Duffy's the apprentice, but it's very close.
Yeah.
Between the two. So at one point, Duffy is decorating in a flat and he decides that the woman he's working for should be taken down a peg or two. And he and Duffy are going to hide in the flat, wait for her to come back and rape her. Fortunately, the lady in question didn't go home that night and the two of them left again. They then find another target.
But, interrupt. They wouldn't have got away with that, though, because if he'd been working there, then...
Well, they did equip themselves with balaclavas.
Okay.
And all sorts of other rape kit, including duct tape knives, which they carried around in the back of the car they shared.
Okay.
They then have another go, another woman, this time in Notting Hill. And Mulcahy decides that she's stuck up and needs to be taught a lesson. So again, they lay in wait. This time, however, she does come home, but with a man. So the two of them leg it out of the bathroom window and across the gardens in a kind of bizarre Keystone Cops kind of escape. And thankfully... these two ladies escaped the attentions of these men. They were extremely lucky. But in October 1982, the pair pull off their first successful rape. A 16-year-old girl is walking home from a party carrying a teddy bear, which she's been given by a friend. The two men stick a knife in her throat, push her into a garden, where she's blindfolded and raped. It's Duffy said afterwards, and I think they're chilling words, "We were both very excited and said we should do it again."
Okay, sorry, Betsy, my dog is hearing a noise and so she's making us aware that she's here. Ooh.
For a while, they go quiet. In fact, it's not until March 1983 they try again. This time, a 29-year-old French woman who's working as a restaurant manager who is leaving or walking past Finchley Road tube station in North London. She puts up a tremendous fight, even though she's knocked to the ground and is kicked. And in the end, I think the two men give up on it and run. But by now, they have a fully blown appetite. They get into a car late at night. They drive round North London looking for victims. They have the kit with them. They have the balaclava and the knives.
I can't imagine what it would be like to have a kind of conversation like that with someone. To be like, let's rape someone. Do you see what I mean?
Like, I do.
How you can like chat to a friend and be like, "Hey, wouldn't it be great? Oh, I really enjoyed that last rape we did. We should do it." Like, this completely blows my mind how two people could sit and have a conversation like that.
Well, it's undoubtedly true they did, because they used to. I think Duffy later described it as we thought it was a game. We liked hunting. They used to drive around with Michael Jackson's Thriller on the cassette player in the car. They used to tour North London, looking for some poor.
And they were married. You said one of them was married.
Both married. Both married quite young. I think Duffy first, and then Mulcahy. Mulcahy married a nursery nurse, and Duffy married an Anglo-Indian. Duffy's treatment of his wife was pretty much the same as Mulcahy's treatment of his, but Mulcahy went on to have four children. Duffy never did have any children, partly as a result of the low sperm count, obviously. But yes, they were married. They, on the surface, they were leading respectable lives. Duffy a carpenter, Mulcahy a plasterer and plumber, both at the one point working for Westminster City Council. The wife's name, Mulcahy married Sandra Carr at 19. No, it's Duffy married Sandra Carr, forgive me. And Mulcahy married Margaret Byron in 1980 at 21. But by now they're on the full-blown search. In January 1984, a 32-year-old American is raped by them on Barnes Common. They've moved away from North London because they were conscious that they shouldn't be do too much in their own backyard. In June 1984, a 20-year-old is grabbed from the waiting room of West Hampstead Railway Station, marched under a bridge, and again, with a knife to her throat, blindfolded and raped. In July that year, they dragged two Danish au pair girls into the bushes at Hampstead Heath, both of whom are raped. In January 1985, we are talking about a spree by now, they attack a German au pair in Brent.
I mean, did the police just were like, oh, look, loads of people are being raped?
Well, the police, to be fair to them, did begin to realise, in fact, they formed a task force called Operation Heart. They did begin to realise that something severe was going on, but there were no, you know, remember we're talking about 1985.
I know it was different then.
It was very different. The attitude to rape in the Metropolitan Police, and indeed in all police forces, was considerably different from the way it is now.
Yeah, I
know that. It took, I remember one victim, heartbreaking statement she made after they were finally caught, in which she said, I went to the police four times and they wouldn't believe me. They wouldn't listen to me. They said I was making it up or it must be my fault.
Mm.
And that, in today's climate, there would have been a far greater outcry, far more quickly. But in that climate, it was prolonged, it was foot dragging, there wasn't the same computer generation, there was the DNA wasn't as sophisticated, it was much more haphazard, and they were dotted, although there were eventually, I mean, when Operation Heart was constructed and brought into action, they took the, I think, very wise precaution of contacting Professor David Cantor, who at that point was beginning what was to become known as geographical profiling. And Cantor put together 17 points of likely similarities. They would be white. They would be probably in their 20s. Mm. They probably lived in North East. They probably had, you know, long connections. They were probably married. You know, a whole list. And when it finally came to Duffy's conviction, 13 of Cantor's 17 points were ticked.
And this was... And he profiled them when?
Well, this was in 85.
And they were finally arrested.
Oh, we'll take a little time to get to that.
Yeah.
I think the thing to remember is these two men had an almost telepathic relationship.
Happy with the way the world is heading? Don't buy this book. Understand why you do what you do? Don't buy this book. At peace with your existence? Don't buy this book. Content with your relationships? Don't buy this book. The follow-up to The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F*** by Mark Manson is finally here. Everything is F***, a book about hope, out now.
Chip. One victim said, and I think it's again terrifying, it was as if there was one body and one mind. They didn't speak to each other. They knew exactly what to do and what they were doing. And I think that's why I've always been convinced that Duffy and Mackay are genuinely folie à deux. It was a complete unity.
What is the definition of folie à deux?
It means that there are two killers who are more dangerous together than they would be individually. The classic English case is Rose and Fred West.
And is it like traditional that they would kind of spur each other on, or is it just they're kind of like two halves to one whole?
No, I think it's usually there is a sorcerer and apprentice. Mm. And in the West, it was obviously Fred was the sorcerer and Rose was the apprentice. And in this case, I think it was Mackay who was the sorcerer and Duffy who was the apprentice. But there's no doubt that there was a complete unity of purpose. They knew precisely what they were planning to do and how they were going to do it. Mm. And there was absolutely no doubt in their minds. And so in 1985, with this spate of rapes now in full flood, mm. Operation Heart is created. And believe it or not, the pair are stopped by the police in the car on one of their tours. And they find the black balaclavas and some knives and some tape. And Mackay says, well, I have to wear a balaclava when I'm plastering ceilings.
And the police believe them?
Yes. They get a fine for carrying offensive weapons.
Cool. Smart work.
Mm. Well, how many times have we talked about opportunities
missed?
A lot of times. But by the end of 1985, it's pretty clear that rape is no longer enough. And on Sunday, the 29th of December, a 19-year-old called Alison Day was the only person to get off a train at Hackney Wick Station.
It's near where I live.
Yep.
Busier train line now.
Oh, I can
imagine. Due to the popularity of living in East London.
Yes, well. It was a particularly brutal rape. They marched her into a snow-covered field. Both raped her. Alison Day tried to escape and may have fallen, or Mackay may have pushed her into a canal that led down to the River Lee. Duffy saved her, got her out of the canal. But by this time, Mackay had lost his temper. And I always remember this quote from Duffy. David actually enjoyed the whole thing, saying it gave him power. Mackay, Duffy said, it's godlike having the decision over life and death. Duffy saved her. Mackay raped her again, then tore her blouse, made it into a tourniquet, and strangled her. Duffy made no attempt to stop him, and indeed watched. They then proceeded to put stones into the pocket of her sheepskin coat. You can imagine it's 1980, the sheepskin coat.
Yeah.
John Motson-style sheepskin coat.
It's the in-between Christmas and New Year time, too.
It is. And they tied her hands behind her back, gagged her, and threw her into the canal. I believe she was dead when she entered the canal again for the second time. She wasn't found for several days. Well, now we really have escalated from rape to murder. And they decide that this is such, and I use the word advisedly, I don't use it in any sense to be flippant. They were having such fun that they wished to continue the adventure.
Mm.
Remember when I was saying that they were hunting, they saw it as a game. We were playing a game together. And these people, they weren't people, they were just simply victims.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that isn't disgraceful. On the contrary, it absolutely is disgraceful. But there is no doubt in my mind, not one iota of doubt, that they were completely disconnected from any kind of conscience, social conscience, remorse, nothing. Did not cross their minds.
They just have, like, no empathy at all.
No, none. Not one iota.
If they were, well, no reason you'd know the answer to this, but, like, if they were out in the pub, for example, and they got into a fight, would they be very aggressive in that scenario? Or was it just more kind of that they couldn't be in that kind of situation, so they could inflict pain or stuff on people outside of that, if you know what I mean?
I do, but I think you have to distinguish here between their attitude to women and their attitude to men.
Oh, yeah.
I think if it were a fight in a pub between men, I think they would probably run in the other direction. But the fact that they target women is about power and control. We've talked about it many times, haven't we?
Yeah.
That rape is all about power and control. It's not just about sex. It's about power and control.
Mm.
And it's about an inbuilt despair, really, over what on earth they are, what kind of person they are. And often a serial rapist, for example, is I'm not excusing it, but is troubled about his own personality, his own sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a desperate attempt to get back on the path. Anyway, that was in December 1985, as you quite rightly say, between Christmas and the New Year. In April, they struck again, this time in Surrey. Operation Heart had been having some success. There'd been a lot of concentration by the police resources on the fact there was a serial rapist, but nobody connected the dots between the rapes in and around that sort of Hampstead, Finchley Road, and the killing of Alison Day in Hackney Wick. Mm. It was also, of course, there wasn't a central crime command at that point. It was all done in the local stations.
So like borough to borough kind of thing, and those are in different boroughs.
And the dots were not joined up.
Yeah, so they weren't speaking all together.
No, one wasn't saying what the other could have heard, you know, and that was I think that's something that many forces have learnt since then, and the Met has learnt, and the Holmes computer system transformed. But again, Holmes at this point is in its infancy. You know, remember the Yorkshire Ripper, they were still using card index files. You know, that's the reason there were so many cards.
Yeah.
Outside East Horsley Station in Surrey in April 1986, they come up with another little plan. They decide they're going to hide in the bushes and they're going to stretch a fishing line across a path in which all sorts of people walk up and down. This bizarre ruse traps a 15-year-old, a Dutch schoolgirl called Marche Tambuza, and flips her off her bicycle. Duffy raped her. Mulcahy has got rather angry. I don't know, perhaps it wasn't violent enough for Mulcahy. Mulcahy wanted more and more violence. And he loses his temper and picks up a stone in one hand and swings it at the 15-year-old. Very hard, bang, on the side of the head. She drops to the ground. Mulcahy takes off a belt, her belt, and winds it round her neck. And this time he says to Duffy, "I killed the last one, you're going to have to kill this one." And they insert a twig, a piece of wood, to turn the tourniquet, the belt, tighter and tighter. And Duffy does indeed strangler. But that wasn't enough for them. They then decided to break her neck and set fire to her.
What? Why?
Mulcahy's reasoning was, if we set fire to her, it'll be very hard for anybody to find this new thing called DNA. That was the
Well, he obviously wasn't the sharpest tool in the toolbox.
No. If I've gone a bit quiet, it's only because I find these two so utterly repulsive and so without any redeeming features whatever that they send literally shivers up and down my spine.
They're really grim. It's with the egging each other on as well. It's so like, oh,
yeah.
There's something, that's the thing I mean about two people sitting down having a conversation about how to inflict pain on somebody else. Well, it's one thing thinking, oh, someone's sitting at home masterminding their kind of creepy serial killer plans. But for two people to sit down and chat about it, it's...
Well, to drive around in their car, listening to Thriller and saying she's a good target.
Mm.
It's a very creepy
really
thing to
gross.
Do.
Yeah, it's really horrible.
Yes. And they were, I think, the wives, the evidence of the wives, which didn't begin to come out until after the third killing, which I'm coming on to. You know, Duffy's wife knew perfectly well he went out at night with a knife and didn't come back until very late in the morning, very early hours. She knew he was going with Mulcahy.
She didn't do anything.
No.
Not that she should have, because it's
no,
not easy
I'm
to
not,
say something.
I'm not attributing blame.
No.
I'm just simply saying it was regarded as acceptable, normal behaviour.
Just what he did.
1 month later, after the poor Dutch girl meets her end, in May 1986, they attack another young woman getting off a train, this time in Brookman's Park in Hertfordshire. She was a secretary at London Weekend Television, just come back from her honeymoon in the Seychelles. She was called Anne Locke. They marched her into a nearby field. Duffy raped her. And Mulcahy told him, here's the car keys, go and get the car.
Their car.
Their car. When Duffy gets back, he realises that something horrible has happened. And Mulcahy says to him, well, she won't identify us now. He suffocated her and with her own sock. Her body wasn't found for a considerable time. And even though she was only a mile from her own home, I can remember the search for her, for whatever happened to Anne Locke, the television appeals, very, very clearly. But then the first break in the case. In August that same year, 1986, Duffy is arrested for beating up his wife and is found to have a very rare blood group.
Oh, thank God
so rare... that it was found at a number of the scenes. Duffy's then identified by two of the rape victims because he has a very pockmarked face because of the acne he'd suffered as a teenager and very, very blue eyes. Mulcahy was questioned, but no evidence was found against him. Duffy never said a word about Mulcahy. And Mulcahy suggested that Duffy really wasn't a bit of a mummy's boy, he called him at one point. You know, I don't believe he could have done that sort of thing. While those investigations were taking place into Duffy, in October 86, a 14-year-old schoolgirl was raped, but her blindfold slipped, and she described a short, pockmarked-faced man with blue eyes and a dog called Bruce. Duffy was put under surveillance, and in November he was arrested. Police searched the house, and guess what? He has a dog called Bruce. They find a very specific string called Somyarn, which was used on a couple of the victims, and particularly matched the stuff that was found on Alison Day's body, the first murder victim's body. Duffy is sent for trial. and in February 1988 is found guilty of 5 rapes and 2 of the murders. He was not convicted at the judge's direction of the murder of Anne Locke because there was insufficient evidence. But the judge did say, when he sentenced him, "You are little more than a predatory animal."
Did they not tell from the evidence and things that he was working in a pair?
They suspected all along that he was not acting alone, but they could never pin down who it was, and Duffy never said. And I think that's a very good point to end this first part of The Railway Killers.
Okay, great. Well, we'll be back with part 2 in 2 weeks.
In Hannibal Lecter, Thomas Harris revealed the face of true evil. Now in Cardi Mora, he shows us the strength of absolute courage. From the legendary author of The Silence of the Lambs comes the new novel, Cardi Mora. Out now in hardback, ebook, and audiobook, narrated by Thomas Harris.